Gordon Cooper was born in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Bet you didn't know that. Attended the University of Hawaii, graduated USAF Institute of Technology with BS in Aeronautical Engineering. He has 11 years of graduate-level training in space technology, space mechanics, lunar geology, spacecraft design, and flight testing with NASA. Also a graduate of USAF Jet Pilot School, USAF Experimental Test Pilot School, USAF Jet Engine Rebuilding School, United States Navy Underwater Demolition Team, and USN Helicopter School. That's a lot of school. Served as experimental flight test project manager and test pilot at Edwards Air Force Base, 1956 through 1959. Selected as a Mercury astronaut in 1959, one of four surviving space pioneers from the days when there was indeed a pretty good possibility of cataclysmic booster failure or even being stranded in space. Today, Gordon Cooper lives in Ventura, California. He's president of Galaxy Group, Inc., a highly experienced engineering design group and engaged generally in modification of existing aircraft and design and manufacture of new aircraft on the drawing board based partly on his own experience with UFOs, is a design for Fantex 2000, a vertical lift craft with saucer-shaped wings attached to a fuselage. Gordon thinks the saucer shape is the way we should have been going with aircraft design for a long time and plans to build this vehicle complete with four vertical lift fans. He flew the last Mercury mission in 1963, 22 times around the Earth, 32 hours, still, by the way, the U.S. record for longest solo space flight. On this flight, at one point, you may recall, if you're old enough, he lost all electronics and then, therefore, was the first man to manually control reentry from space. Here is Gordon Cooper. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. Good to be here.
Our phone connection is not the greatest in the world, Gordon, so you're probably going to have to try and scream at me if you can.
Okay.
That's better. Gordon, you are now in your 70s, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm 72.
72. Did you think, you know, as you think back on it, you were a test pilot. I mean, a lot of test pilots died testing airplanes. Did you ever figure to make it to your 70s?
Well, of course, I'd always hoped to, right? Of course, in those days, 70s sounded pretty old.
That's right. That's right. But, I mean, many times during your career, you must have thought, you know, I'm going to roll the dice, I'm going to roll the dice, and I'm going to roll the dice, and one of these times is going to come up the wrong way.
Well, I think most, particularly fighter pilots and test pilots, have become kind of fatalists. You know, they figure when it's your time to go, you're going to go, and no sense in jumping out in front of the truck, but on the other hand, when it's your time, why, you'll go.
Then the next question might be, why be a test pilot? In other words, my passion is radio, Gordon. God, I'm consumed by it. I have been all my life, and I would presume your answer would be pretty much the same way. Consumed by aircraft and flying. Is that it?
Well, that's right. And when you really look at it, the fatality rate among test pilots and certainly among space flyers has been pretty good. We have worse fatalities out on the highways.
Actually, that's quite true, isn't it? You were on some of the on top. as a matter of fact, in the Right Stuff, I think toward the end, right at the end of the Right Stuff, it showed you on top of the booster. This booster.
Atmos booster.
Yeah, you know, and running through your mind at a moment like that. I mean, what does run through your mind at a moment like that? You're sitting on a virtual bomb if it decides to go that way.
Well, you just hope that all those people that built all those little parts and tested them out so carefully did a good job on them.
Oh. I forget. I think it might have been in some recent space movie I saw just before launch, one of the astronauts commented that, do you realize how many moving parts this thing has, and they were all built by the lowest bidder?
That's true.
I guess that's probably true, too. And at other times, Gordon, you, I know, saw some of our rockets blow up. And I guess when you stand there and you're fairly close and you see one blow up, that has to be imprinted very heavily on your mind. When you're
It
is, yeah. That's what I thought.
You just hope the one you're riding doesn't blow up like that.
A lot of most Americans wouldn't begin to understand why a person would be willing to roll the dice that way. What is so exciting? What is so magnetic to get somebody like yourself to do that?
Well, it's a fascinating job, and it's a good job. It's very self-satisfying to be able to do a good job in very, you know, high technology job.
You you flew a lot of experimental jets as well. Was that did you ever get close to trouble in any of those?
Oh yes, on occasion.
With respect to the last Mercury mission, to all of a sudden lose all of your electronics, just all your electronics suddenly gone, do you think you were going to live through that?
Yes, I was planning on it. I had done some practicing on that in the simulator, figuring the worst thing that could happen would be to lose all your electronics. So I had practiced on the simulator quite a bit on that very thing.
Was it a tough thing to do? In other words, manual reentry. The astronauts today, of course, all rely on computers and backups to that. But is it a pretty narrow window? In other words, do you have to do it very carefully, lest you burn up?
Well, you have a fairly narrow window to hit. You can't come in too steep, or you can't go in too shallow. So it's a fairly narrow window, but it's not that difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to stay on top of it.
So what instruments do you watch when you're manually reentering that keep you within this narrow little window with no electronics at all?
Well, the main thing you have to do is keep the rates from building, because the spacecraft is basically unstable. And as it starts to oscillate around roll, pitch, and yaw, you have to crack those rates out. But you don't have any attitude instruments to look at. With electric failure, they're all gone.
So it's kind of like going down a curved road with a car or something. In other words, you keep correcting.
That's correct.
Huh. Gordon, there have been a million rumors over the years that have flown around about you. With regard to a UFO that you supposedly saw on a Mercury mission. Now, That rumor isn't true, is it? You didn't see one, did you?
No, somebody made a lot of money selling a bunch of lies on that one.
Did they?
Yeah, it was totally untrue.
But somehow, once they told it, though, the story stuck no matter what.
Oh, yeah, it even got embellished on several times.
Huh. The funny thing is that even though that's a complete BS story, the fact of the matter is, you have seen UFOs, haven't you?
Well, on one occasion, I saw some strange vehicles that we finally assumed were UFOs.
Where was this?
But I never had the occasion to really see one up close.
Where did you see this?
Over Germany.
In Germany. Can you describe what you did see?
Well, it looked just like they were at fairly high altitude, and it looked like flights of fighters flying the same basic kind of formation that we fly in fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going in general from east to west. And when we got scrambled off of some of our airplanes and tried to get up closer to them to see what they were very, they were looking just like saucers. They're metallic looking, but we couldn't get any close enough to get any more detail than that.
But you got enough detail to see that they looked like saucers.
Yeah, you couldn't see any wings on them.
No wings. And their speed relative to yours?
Considerably faster.
Did you report that?
Oh, yes, it got reported.
How did they handle the report?
Well, I don't know. I was just a lowly first lieutenant at that time, so I don't know how the report was handled.
How did you handle it? In other words, you saw something that obviously was not one of ours.
Well, it was not one of ours, but of course, it was during the height of the Cold War with Russia at that point in time, and we really had no way of knowing what Russia might be, might have designed and might be building. So we really couldn't rule out that it might be some kind of new Russian aircraft.
One of theirs.
Right.
Well, looking back on it now, I don't think they had anything like that, or at least history presently doesn't tell us they do, so I guess it wasn't one of theirs. And I guess it must make you wonder a lot today.
Yeah, but looking back now, I suspect it was some kind of extraterrestrial vehicle.
I understand that some of your film following a Gemini 5, mission, was confiscated. They came and they confiscated your film. You had apparently been taking shots from orbit, I guess. And, you know, it says here in the material that was sent to me, Gordon, that you were able to, now, bear in mind, folks, how long ago this is. You were able to get photographs good enough to show license plates on cars on the ground. Is that true?
That's true.
From orbit.
Yes, well, we were using a 1,250-millimeter Questar lens, so you might expect to get some pretty good detail.
Well, you might, but, you know, years and years and years ago, we were boasting that the very best satellite spy satellites we had were capable of getting, perhaps, a license plate or something like that. so if you could do that then, one has to wonder what they can do today.
Yeah, I would assume that we've improved over that considerably.
you overflew. Looking back on it now, I understand you were really angry when they confiscated your film. Looking back on it, do you think it was? I mean, why do you think they took that film?
Well, I think. I only found out fairly recently, in just recent years, from one of the men who was involved in the confiscation, that the reason it got confiscated was that I had inadvertently made, we were asked to make pictures of airfields and pictures of ships at sea and pictures of cars in parking lots so they could measure resolution. And one of these airfields that I had come over and snapped unknowingly turned out to be some little area they called Area 51.
Area 51.
Yeah, how about that?
How about that? Do you know where I am, Gordon? Do you know?
Oh, where are you?
No, you don't know. I'm in a little town called Pahrump, Nevada.
Oh, yeah.
And you see, just over the mountain from me, Gordon, is Area 51. It's just over a mountain range here. And I'm telling you, Gordon, we see things from time to time in this town, and just about everybody in this town can tell a story that absolutely cannot be accounted for. They simply can't be accounted for. In my own case, I saw a large, triangular, silent craft pass directly over my head. I was standing there with my wife, silently, not making a sound, floating, not flying, doing, 30 miles an hour, perhaps not enough to support aerodynamic flight of any sort that I know. I was in the Air Force, and I used to get to fly in C-130s a lot, Gordon, and so I know what a C-130 is. And 2 weeks after I saw what I saw, a report came out in our local newspaper which said, yes, indeed, on that night there had been a secret mission that may have overflown the Pahrump Valley, that's where I live, and that it was a C-130 aircraft. And I had never been so insulted in my entire life. So we see these things, and they probably come and go from Area 51. As a test pilot, Gordon, what do you imagine? I probably shouldn't even ask this. What do you imagine? I mean, after all, the stealth now is why it's old news.
Oh yeah.
So what do you imagine we're working on now?
I don't know, but I hope we're working on something exciting because we're spending a lot of money apparently there. I would hope with all the money we're spending that we're getting, you know, something pretty exciting.
Return for the tax dollar?
Right. And I'm sure we probably are.
I'm sure we are. All right, Gordon, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to U.S. astronaut Gordon Cooper. And this is a unique opportunity to ask him just about every question I can think of about what it's like to be in space, what it's like to sit on top of one of those rockets, and, yes, what may be out there that we don't know about, or maybe we simply don't admit it. So we'll try and cover as much of that ground as we can. Gordon Cooper, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right. Once again, Gordon Cooper, and the name of the book is Leap of Faith. Gordon, why is it called Leap of Faith? Why that book title?
Well, my spacecraft, the Mercury spacecraft, was named Faith 7.
Faith 7.
So I guess that was kind of a nice tie-in.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, maybe it's your publisher, HarperCollins, putting words in your mouth, but these are pretty strong words. It says here, Leap of Faith is Gordon's first-person story told in his own words with his co-author, Bruce Henderson. Though it is part memoir and part adventure, its underpinning from beginning to end is his strong and unshakable belief in extraterrestrial intelligence. That's an incredible statement. Is that true?
Well, I certainly believe that God created a tremendous big universe for us, and everyone who's gone into space, you know, it's a very great humbler because you realize what a big, monstrous place this universe is. Mm-hmm. And when you think about possibly 400 other planets that we know of right now that could have atmosphere similar to ours, it makes you wonder if we aren't being kind of vain if we think that God populated only this one planet.
That's right. And as they said in the movie Contact, what a great waste of space it would be.
Right.
When you were in orbit, you were there for quite a while, 22 orbits, 32 hours, that's a long time. You would have time, I would presume, during that time to look out from your spacecraft and and yourself contemplate everything that you're seeing, which is a lot more than we see down here. And did those kinds of thoughts and wonderings cross your mind then, Gordon?
Oh, I suppose so, yes. And you're right. And the interesting thing that when you're up in orbit, out of all the atmosphere and everything, you see about 100 times the amount of stars that you see here on Earth. Really amazing, you know, you realize that there are just millions and millions and millions of them out there. And many, many, many of those stars you're looking at are the suns of another solar system.
Yeah, kind of like from 2010. Oh, my God, he said. The stars.
Yeah, that's right.
Full of stars. Yes, and now we know, as you point out, that there are probably planets around many, many of those stars. We're finding more all the time, so the probability of life would seem rather high. You combine that with the the meteorite that they just found with saline water inside of it. And gee whiz, the probability of life seems to get higher and higher and bigger
yeah.
out there. So
we haven't even totally ruled out the fact that whether there may, if not now, but certainly there, at one time there may have been life on Mars.
In fact, it is likely that at one time, or at least possible, there was life on Mars. We know there was an atmosphere. We know there was water
right.
once on Mars. All of that's true. I guess I can't resist, Gordon, so I'll ask you. There's been a lot of controversy about the face, the so-called face on Mars. And they have gone back and they have re-photographed the face on Mars in what many people consider to be an angle that did not do service to the first photograph that we saw. In other words, it was at such a terrible angle that, frankly, it looked like a filled cat box or something, mm-hmm. rather than a face. What do you think about the face on Mars?
I just don't know. You know, it could either be something that someone made, like some of the big symbols that were done down in Central and South America, or it could be just a natural erosion of some kind, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know what to make of it. And I guess that's one of the reasons we need to send some manned missions to Mars and check some of those things out a little closer.
Gordon, let me ask you this, and I'm sure that you are very loyal to NASA, but is NASA today the same NASA when you flew?
Well, no, it's of course much bigger, and being bigger and more bureaucratic is certainly probably somewhat more inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
But NASA does a tremendous lot of good and a lot of good work. And if I can criticize, one of the things I can criticize NASA the most on is the fact they really don't toot their own horn quite enough. Because they do a lot of good work in aviation, friends, that people aren't even aware of.
That's absolutely true. You're right. They don't toot their horn a lot, and their horn does not get tooted all that much anymore by the media at all. They just don't treat spaceflight the way they once did.
No, they don't.
What do you think happened to the American people? You think they got...
Well, of course, I think if we... Again, I think if we start going back to the moon and doing some manned Mars landings, we'll find that the people are still just as interested as ever.
Gordon, it's been 30 years plus since we went to the moon. That's a long, long time.
Okay.
I remember it, of course. I'm old enough. I'm 54, and so I remember it as a child. And we haven't gone back.
That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yes, it is unbelievable. Why?
Oh, I don't know. You can say politics, or you can say all kinds of reasons, but I just think we have not had an administration in that really had the courage and the wisdom to really put things together and really get going on again. And certainly a lot of it has been NASA's fault, too. NASA has not had the courage or the wisdom that the NASA years ago had.
Ah, well, that's exactly what I meant when I asked you that question about NASA then and NASA now. NASA then was much more of an adventuresome organization, much more of a risk-taker. And I guess it's not surprising, is it, Gordon, that as an organization gets larger, it takes fewer risks.
Well, they get beat up pretty bad by the politicians, too. You know, Congress beats the heck out of NASA all the time, and I'm sure they get kind of beat down, you know, from time to time.
NASA, when they are asked about the possibility of extraterrestrial life, or even more directly to the point, the possibility that there are things in our skies that cannot be explained, NASA does get a bit defensive on the issue. Gordon, they don't like talking about that sort of thing. We had a great big investigation in this country called Project Blue Book. as you well know, that ended with the statement that whatever these are, and they certainly could not explain everything they investigated, they are not a threat to national security. Can you buy that statement?
No. Of course, Blue Book was done by the Air Force, not by NASA.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And Blue Book was, in my opinion, was strictly a cover-up to, you know, just whitewash the whole thing, and hopefully the whole thing would go away.
Blue Book was strictly a cover-up and a whitewash.
In my opinion, that's what it was, right.
Okay. Gordon, in your opinion, should there be a modern-day version of Project Blue Book, or whatever it is they would like to call it today, that would investigate what is in our skies? Is there sufficient evidence to warrant reopening all of this legitimately this time?
Well, I suppose if you could have a centralized, I had recommended several years ago that we use the United Nations, you know, as a repository for all the information and all the investigative teams' data to come into to one central location that was sort of a neutral ground. I don't know where it's, you know, I don't really care where it's done, but you do need somewhere where to kind of correlate all these sightings and all the data that's brought in to see whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Do you think such a thing is politically possible right now?
I don't know. Very likely it is.
It may just be. Some recent surveys of the American people, Gordon, have been very revealing, and a majority of the American people now believe that these things do fly in our skies. They believe they are real. And if you have that kind of consensus, you would think that would give some of the politicians enough backbone to call for such an investigation.
Yeah, you would think so. It certainly would have a good chance of getting a very favorable reception from the public.
You had an experience which I have heard about over the years, Gordon, at Edwards Air Force Base. Something about a couple of cameramen. Can you tell me about that, with a close encounter with something or another?
Well,
that
my experience is really secondhand, but I had a crew who was working for me who was photographing a landing, a Scania site, new one they were installing on the edge of the dry lake bed. And this saucer flew in over him and landed.
A saucer.
Down from the landing gear and landed about 50 yards from him. They proceeded on to go over closer to it to get pictures, and it lifted up, put the gear back up, and took off.
Did they get pictures of it?
They got pictures.
They did.
And then I had to go dig through all the rags and find out what, you know, who to call in Washington to report this as per regulation.
Wait a minute. You made the call to Washington?
Right. While they were developing the film.
And, what kind of call was that?
Well, as per Air Force rag number, da 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 da. I can't remember the numbers of them now, but if an unusual sighting is made of any kind of unidentified flying object, you will call this particular number and report.
Oh, really? No kidding. I had, first of all, I'd never even heard that there was a special number for a UFO, unidentified flying object, whatever you want to call it. But there is such a number, was such a number, and you called it.
And I called it.
And you said, guess what? We've got photographs of
a strange little vehicle that doesn't seem to have any wings on it.
Strange vehicle that doesn't seem to have wings that landed at Edwards Air Force Base.
Right.
I see. And what did the person on the other end say?
Just a minute, and I'll get Colonel so-and-so. And then before long, I was talking to some general.
A general? Uh-huh.
And then he proceeded to tell me, do not run prints of those films, of the negatives. Just put them in a pouch, and we're making arrangements to have them flown to Washington immediately.
He told you, don't make prints, fly him to Washington right away.
Right.
And I assume that is precisely what you did.
We put him in a pouch, and some guy came around to the office and picked him up in a pouch, and that's the last I saw him.
And how long was it before some general called you back to explain exactly what it was that was in the photographs?
Well, that was 40 years ago, and I'm still waiting.
Phone hasn't rung yet.
Phone hasn't rung yet.
Gordon, I...
Generals don't generally call captains back and explain things, though, you know, frequently, so...
Uh-huh. But, I mean, as you pointed out, it's been all those years, and you rose in the ranks, and you did a lot of things that would, you know, got you... a lot of public exposure, and you might imagine that the general might have called you back some years later, but no, huh?
Well, who knows? Maybe he retired right after that or something.
Oh, he retired?
No, I say maybe he did.
How many people, Gordon, do you think in high positions are retiring with knowledge of the kinds of things that you and I are talking about right now, taking it to their grave?
Oh, I just don't know. It'd be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. I want to ask you about something else. Over the years, Gordon, a lot of astronauts, Neil Armstrong, for example, at the White House, and many other occasions, a lot of astronauts have made very, very provocative statements that don't quite say that there are that we are being visited, that the things in our skies are real. They don't quite say that, Gordon, but they almost say it. Neil Armstrong particularly alluded to some just some incredible things that will be coming down the line. And do you think that other astronauts are afraid to really tackle this issue straight on?
Well, I think most people are in government, whether it's in NASA or in the Department of Defense, are a little cautious about what they say because there have been so many lies made up about UFOs, and so many lies have been made up about all the space flights and all the you know, the various things to do with NASA and with space, that I think everybody's a little skeptical about saying anything to anybody.
It'd be kind of like stepping in front of a podium, I suppose, and presenting the latest theory on who killed Kennedy.
Right.
It would be lost in the shuffle. It would be part of the noise. There's so much noise on the subject that, of course, coming from somebody like yourself, or Neil Armstrong, or anybody who's been in our space program, the words that you're saying tonight carry a lot of weight with the American people. Could you have spoken out in the way you're speaking out now when your career was active, when you were still in the space program, and if you had, what would have happened?
Well, I don't think anything would have happened. I always have spoken out pretty loud and clear on it. I've never had any warnings from anybody in either Department of Defense or NASA against speaking out or saying things. Contrary to what some news media are always saying, that, you know, we're always warned not to say anything. I've never had any suppression of all of my speaking out.
Would it be your opinion, Gordon, that our government is very well aware of these things, doing tremendous speeds and maneuvers in and just above our atmosphere, that they are fully aware of this?
I sure hope they are.
But is there any way with you, the technology that you know and I know they have, that they could not be aware of it?
No, I think there's just too many, you know, too many solid citizen people who have seen things to totally disregard it. And certainly, you know, we even have had the skeptics who have always said that the the speed of light is definitely by far the greatest limitation of any kind of speed we move at, and yet every physicist in the block is now amazing neutrinos and zipping around at many times the speed of light.
That's
all
right.
Over space.
That's right. And so you don't imagine that a violation of Einstein's a theory about not being able to exceed the speed of light. You rather imagine that sometime in our distant future, or somebody else's present, it's already been achieved.
Well, even Einstein was modifying all his formulas when he was using time. When he went back and started using time as a variable rather than a constant, and so before he died, he was opening up his theories to greater and greater speed.
That's right, he was. All right, Gordon, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. You okay to go ahead?
Sure.
Good, excellent. Stay right where you are. We are honored this night to be speaking with Gordon Cooper, U.S. astronaut Gordon Cooper. And when we get back, we'll come back for a moment to the incident at Edwards Air Force Base. Send the negatives. Send them now. Don't make any prints. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, here is Gordon Cooper. Gordon, going back again to 1957 at Edwards, we did talk about the photographs that were taken, and it's my understanding that before you sent off these photographs as ordered, you got to see them. You actually got to see the negatives.
Right.
Now,
see the negative.
Uh-huh. Apparently, the cameramen were told that what was in the negative was a balloon.
And several years later, when things came out on it, that was my understanding that someone had interviewed them, and they were told that that's what the pictures were of.
I think that's what the story generally was from about 1940-something or another, maybe the 50s, whatever it was, it's a balloon.
That weather balloon seemed to get around a lot, didn't it?
Well, I understand you were able to observe, at least in the negatives, that it had a tricycle-like landing gear.
Right.
Interesting balloon.
Yeah, the only balloon I've ever seen with landing gear. Although, you know, it's funny, one time I was two T-38s full of us, Pete Conrad and I, and Neil Armstrong and Elliot C. were heading up to St. Louis to do some work on Gemini 5 spacecraft. And we were cruising along around 40-something thousand feet in two T-38s, just loose formation. And I looked out about 10 o'clock high and said, "What do you see out there about 10 o'clock high?" And Neil came back with, "I don't know that I really want to say what it looks like."
Really?
And so we finally called flight service and said, we'd like to climb considerably higher and get on up to check something out up here. And they said, "Okay, go ahead. You're no obstructions." We climbed, put in the afterburners, and climbed, got up to it and pulled up alongside. And it was a great big weather balloon with a radio package hanging underneath it.
It was a weather balloon.
It was a weather balloon. After all the criticism I made of weather balloons, there was one that looked very much like a saucer from a distance.
Sure. Sure. If it's round and you're looking at it from below,
yeah,
it's going to look a lot like a saucer, no question about it. So, anyway, your real personal opinion is that there is something going on and that it's worth investigation.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Gordon, most Americans, unfortunately, because at least Americans my age, are never going to get to go to orbit. They're never going to be in space. They're never going to know what it feels like.
Well, don't give up yet.
Well, I'm not giving up, but I mean, I just, you know, kind of looking around at the odds right now, I'd say it doesn't look too good. When you first experience weightlessness, Is it a terrifying feeling of falling, as I've heard people describe it? Do you get used to it? Do you enjoy it after a while? What's it like?
Oh, you get used to it very rapidly. It's an unusual feeling, but it's very relaxing, and you get used to it very rapidly, and it is a very enjoyable feeling. And when you come back to when you have weight again back on Earth, you realize how heavy you are.
Did you get sick at all?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Now, was that because of I presume you guys went through a lot of testing with what they called the vomit comet or something or another that would produce temporary states of weightlessness in a dive, right?
Yeah. You climb, and then as you climb over the top, you know, in this climb, you're going across the top where you're in a situation of weightlessness.
Well, a lot of people are wondering, one of the mandates, Gordon, that NASA has is to begin to privatize space. And it's really one of the things that has not come to fruition. Now, they were mandated by Congress to begin to privatize space. And if it could ever get in the private sector, then maybe some people could literally go to space on vacation someday, I'm sure. Do you believe that that process should be hurried?
Well, I think that it is coming along a little slower than everyone had hoped, but there are a number of companies that are building spacecraft of different kinds and several different companies building boosters. In the private sector. I think we will see space begin to have quite a bit of privatization occurring fairly shortly.
So we're on the verge of it, you think?
I think we are, right.
You are in the middle of, apparently, this Galaxy Group, which is producing, among many other things, something called the Fantex 2000, a vertical lift craft with saucer-shaped wings. Why do you think, it says here that you think the saucer shape is the way we should have been going with aircraft design for a long time. Why?
Well, one of the reasons we did not years back is that we had no artificial stability system. And a saucer is inherently neutrally or slightly unstable. And with the old advent of mechanical control systems, you perhaps could have some trouble controlling it. But now with artificial stability, there's no reason why you can't take advantage of all the aerodynamics that you get off a saucer. And a saucer certainly has very interesting aerodynamics compared to a wing.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't even understand the aerodynamics of a saucer. I understand a wing, and I understand lift, and I understand aerodynamic flight, and I don't understand how to relate that to something in a saucer shape.
Well, a saucer really is just like a wing, just like the whole vehicle really is a lifting body or lifting wing.
Well, if you are heading a company that is doing this, then is it too much of a leap of faith to imagine that they've got saucer-shaped flying things out at Area 51?
Well, as I said earlier, I certainly hope they do. I hope they're, really a few generations ahead of the aircraft that we all see around.
At least a few. We've got some people who would like to ask you questions, Gordon, so
okay. Let's
try that. On the first-time caller line, you're on the air with Gordon Cooper and Art Bell. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Art, and good morning, Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
This is Space Mummy at AOL. You probably remember me. I've sent you numerous emails.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anyway, I listen to your show almost every night, and you got a great show, Art.
Thank you. Do you have a question for Gordon?
Yes, this is the question for Gordon. Gordon, I believe it was Neil Armstrong who made a remark, while walking on the moon. This is during the live actual broadcast when he said that he saw what looked like footprints on the moon. Do either one of you remember Mr. Armstrong making that statement?
I do not. Gordon, do you?
No, I don't remember that.
Would you like to have gone to the moon?
Yes.
You probably would have been a pretty good guy to have along with respect to Apollo 13, with the kind of hands-on experience that you had. Were you ever a candidate for a flight of that sort, or ever considered?
Oh, yes. I was in the I had an Apollo backup team and was in the crew selection process.
I watched a number of programs, Gordon, about the astronaut preparations and the backup teams and so forth. And were people thinking that it would not be too bad if somebody got the flu on the wrong day?
You mean before flight, or?
Well, I mean that. If somebody who might get flu leaving a seat open for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was always open to that, I guess.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Gordon Cooper. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bell.
Hi.
Mr. Cooper.
Yeah.
My grandfather was in the... in World War II, and he was a prisoner of war, and he died 6 years ago. His name was Hammack. His last name was Hammack, and he expressed to me that if I ever could speak to you, that I should tell you that you are a true patriot.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank him for me.
I don't know that if he ever met you or knew you. Apparently he knew you, but I don't know what the connection is, but...
He must have known something.
Yes, sir.
To make that comment.
Yes, sir.
All right, well, thank you very, very much for that. Gordon, I don't know if you can answer this or not, or maybe you can just say you can't answer it, which will tell us as much as really, I guess... an answer would, or nearly as much, and that is this question. Are there many things that occurred to you during the time you were in the space program or during all the years that you were connected to NASA and experimental aircraft, are there many things that even today you can't talk about?
No, there aren't.
Not really?
No.